Welcome to the Shir and Shem Yishmol Parshas Bamidbar. The piece I wanted to see tonight is on page Yud Aleph. For those who have Sfarim, it's the first piece from Shnas Tov Reish Ayin Beis, in other words, 1912. Again, relatively soon, about 2 years after the Rebbe had taken over his position. We know that Bamidbar is referred to by Chazal as Chumash HaKudim, the Chumash that deals with counting and the census, and of course that's because the beginning of Bamidbar, there's quite a great deal paid, quite a great deal of attention paid to counting and getting an exact reckoning and the like. So the piece, the Shem Yishmol, focuses on the need for this counting, what exactly this counting accomplishes, and we'll see some very beautiful thoughts that he expresses. B'dvar minyan Yisrael lo mahutzrach, concerning the counting of the Jewish people, why it's necessary. So the Shem Yishmol starts off quoting a Rashi. The Rashi, the kishenaflu bo'egel mena'am leida minyan hanosarim. Rashi notes that when the Jewish people fell, or there were many Jewish people who were killed after the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, so God counted them in order to know how many Jews were left. And similarly, when God wanted to bring His Shekhinah upon them, to cause the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, to rest upon them, He also counted them. Right, the Shem Yishmol doesn't quote it, but Rashi explains what he means by that. The echad b'nisan hu kama mishkan, the echad b'ir mina'am. Right, the mishkan was erected on the first of Nisan, and the counting took place, and as is explained in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, the counting took place in the beginning of Iyar. Right, so the mishkan had just been set up. It was a vehicle for Ashras Hashchina, for the Shechina coming down and resting upon the Jewish people. So now that was about to be put into effect, Kadosh Baruch Hu counted the Jewish people, presumably, and we'll see this discussed, presumably because if you're going to bring down the Shechina, you need to know how many people you're bringing it down for. Right, that's the simple, but not so simple pshat in Rashi. Right, if you're turning on the electricity, you need to know how many people are benefiting from the electricity. So right off the bat, even as we say it over, right, you can see that there's something that doesn't quite fit with that. And the Shem Yishmol calls our attention to it. The Lechara Eino move on, the Kamish Shmaya Galya. It's hard to understand what Rashi is saying over here. God's going to cause the Shekhinah to rest upon the Jewish people, so He has to count them to know how many people are going to be recipients of the Shekhinah. In the eyes of heaven, before heaven, it's revealed. God knows how many Jews there are. God doesn't have to count, right? Whatever calculation needs to be made in order to figure out, how much Shekhinah per capita, how much Shekhinah per head in Klal Yisrael, the Ribbono Shel Olam can do that instantaneously, whatever that means anyway. So why is there a need for a count? Bishlama kishenaflu bo'egel mina'am. I understand the first part of what Rashi says. Says the Shem Yishmol that God counted the Jewish people after the Egel in order to know and to establish how many people were left. I understand that, even though, again, there too you can say that, God knows, in an instant how many people died and how many people left. But I understand the rationale for counting over there. Shehula Hodia, Shebechesed Hashem Aleim, Apacharam Agefa V'Hariga, Lo Nechzer Miminyonom. Says the Shem Yishmol, I read a long piece, but let's just try to summarize it. Says the Shem Yishmol, obviously God knows how many Jews fell in the Egel and how many Jews were left over, but the rationale in counting the Jewish people after the Chet HaEgel was more to demonstrate to the nations of the world, to the outside nations, that the Jews were not so bad. Because basically, says the Shem Yishmol, if you compare the count of the Jewish people before the Chet HaEgel and the count of the Jewish people after the Chet HaEgel, relatively speaking, it's pretty much the same number of people, right? Which is to basically demonstrate that the casualties who fell after the Chet HaEgel were relatively few in number, again about 3,000 people. They were mostly from the Erev Rav, and you know, by counting the Jewish people, the point is not for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to gain any new information, but rather to display to the world at large, you know, the Jewish people may have sinned with the Egel, but don't think that they're a bunch of grievous sinners who are irredeemable. No, you know, about 3,000 out of the 600,000 people died. It's terrible, it's tragic. But statistically speaking, it's a relatively small percentage of the Jewish people. In theory, I mean, God forbid, we could have imagined the scenario where half the Jewish people is wiped out, Cholila, after the Ma'aseh HaEgel, right? The fact that that's not the case, and the fact that that's demonstratively not the case, by virtue of the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam counts the Jewish people after the Chet HaEgel, and you see, pretty much the same, is a sign for the entire world. Okay, the Jewish people sin, but you know, don't assume the worst of them. They're still pretty much a good people.
But if we think that the sin wasn't that big, then why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to go through these conversations with God and then to learn how to ask for rachamim? And you know, it sort of contradicts each other.
Right. So I mean, the answer is, it's obviously not, it wasn't a walk in the park, you know, the Chet HaEgel obviously has serious ramifications. The Pasuk says to this day, we still bear the after effects of the Chet HaEgel. But at the same time, you know, the Jewish people's role could have been much worse than it actually was. Again, we're judged by a higher standard, that's always the case. You know, Don't beat us up too much, right? In other words, recognize that as much as we sin, then we bear responsibility, etc. But you know, we really could have sinned much more grievously, and that's an important point to make. You know, you have to, in any situation, that the glass is sometimes half full and half empty simultaneously. You know, we did something really bad over here, but you know, look at the bright side also. That's the point. So says the Shemi Shmuel, so that's the rationale when it comes to counting after the Chet HaEgel. So I get that. You know, God doesn't need that for himself. God is making a point, you know, it has PR value, so to speak, you know, to count the Jewish people after the Chet HaEgel. Aval kishabol lahashros shunoso aleihem. But with regard to the second thing that Rashi says, that when God is about to cause His Shechina, His divine presence, to rest on the Jewish people, that God needs to count them somehow before doing so, that has nothing to do with PR. That has nothing to do with people. That's entirely an issue between God and the Jewish people. So what's the point of counting them if God Himself obviously knows how many Jews there are? So what is he seeking to demonstrate to anyone by counting the Jewish people prior to having the Shechina rest upon them? Right? So the Ramban writes a different reason. The Ramban says that the reason God counted the Jewish people at this point was to convey a message to the Jewish people that God has done chesed to them. Namely, look, you went down to Egypt, you were only 70 in number, and look at how many you are now. But says the Shem Yishvul, v'zeinu muvan. That's also hard to understand. You know, that the whole point is to show the Jewish people how much they've grown. The Jewish people were already counted after the Chet HaEgel. And the numbers are basically the same. So what is the, again, what is the role of this count, particularly according to Rashi, that somehow the Jewish people need to be counted before the Shechina can rest upon them? What does that mean? So to answer this, he says the following. You know, the Jewish people are compared famously to the stars. God tells Avram Avinu, look up at the stars. Look up at the sky, see how many stars you are. There are koyi ezarecha. That's how many children you're going to have. Uparshas Akedo nemar kikochve hashamayim v'chachol asher al sfas hayom. when God first conveys to Avraham Avinu that the Jewish people are going to be numerous, he just uses the imagery of stars. But later on, after the Akedah, after the binding of Yitzchak, so the Ribbono Shel Olam uses a double metaphor to describe how numerous the Jewish people are going to be. Your children, he tells Avraham Avinu, are going to be like the stars in the sky and the sand on, and the sand on the shore. Yesh l'sponei. Lama nemu shveim kechach le'ashamayim l'chachol. Why do you need two metaphors? Right? Your children are going to be like the stars and like the sand. Right, so the Shem Yishmol is not the first one to ask this question. The Gemara in Ksubis raises this question. And the Gemara essentially says it's not a question of numbers, it's a question of position. If the Jewish people behave, you'll be up there like the stars. If the Jewish people don't behave, you'll be down there like the dirt, like the sand. You know, nothing to do with how numerous you are, it's a question of your relative position in the world. That's the Gemara in Ksubis says. But the Shem Yishmuel is not referencing that Gemara in Ksubis, presumably because the simple pshat in the pasuk seems to say that the metaphor is being used to describe something about how numerous the Jewish people are. You know, not about their position, but literally, you know, just simply how numerous they are. So, if that's the case, says the Shem Yishmuel, we go back to the original question. If it's all about how numerous the Jewish people are, why use two metaphors? Are there more stars or are there more grains of sand on the sea? So I don't know the answer to that question. But whatever the answer to that question is, just pick the bigger number and use that as the metaphor. And if the point is, your children are going to be vast, so pick the better metaphor and use it. You know, you take away a little bit by saying two metaphors if one is going to be less than the other. So answers to Shem Yishmuel, v'nireh, v'zeh v'kamus, v'zeh v'echus. The reason that there are two metaphors is because one metaphor speaks to the quantity of the Jewish people, the other metaphor speaks to the quality of the Jewish people. D'kachol heim v'kamus, when it comes to quantity, they're like the grains of sand on the shore. I guess the Shem Yishmuel assumed that there were more grains of sand than there are stars. We need an astronomer or a graniologist, you know, to really answer that question properly. Either an astronomer or a guy who hangs out on the beach a lot. But I guess he assumes that there's more sand than there are stars, right? What's that? Right, you can't really count. So that begs the question as to why use two metaphors? And it would be fine. Okay, there are a lot of things I can't count, you know, like whatever. So he says the sand is a function of how numerous the Jewish people are. V'kachochovim heim ve'ekus. Sheyistrol chashuvim ugdolim kikochovim. When the Jewish people are described as being like the stars, that's a description not of quantity, but of quality. That the Jewish people are going to be great and important like the stars themselves are. So in other words, after the test of the Akedah, right, God comes to Avraham Avinu and he says, you know, you have just done something incredible. Your children are going to be numerous and they're also going to be of great quality. By the way, and just on the level of Pashut of Pshat, on the simple level of interpretation, it would seem to me, again, the Shem Yishmuel doesn't say this explicitly, but it would seem to me that the role of stars changes from the first time God speaks to Avraham Avinu about your children being like the stars to the second time that he tells them that they're going to be like the stars. Meaning what? God initially shows Avraham Avinu the stars and he says, you can't count the stars, that's how your children are going to be. On the level of simple pshat, it would seem that clearly, thank you, it would seem that clearly in that context, God is utilizing the stars as an expression of quantity. Right? Look up there, you can't count the stars, that's how many kids you're going to have. After the Akedah, the stars are also referenced, but the metaphor is a different metaphor, according to the Shem Yishmuel. Your children are going to be like the sand on the shore in number. And your children are going to be like the stars in greatness. right? In other words, same stars, but different imagery, different metaphor that's meant to be conveyed in each case, right? So,
what is that? What is that other matter, Rabbi? Where they say if the Jews don't act a certain way, they'll be trampled on other feet like the sand.
Right, right. So that's the Gemara in Ksuvos that says that, but that's different than what the Shemesh Mol is saying over here. Right? The Shemesh Mol is working with the simple reading of the Pesukim, which, you know, again seems to focus on the idea of quantity as opposed to relative position in the world. I'm skipping a little bit to the next page, to Yud Beis, for those who have a sefer. Yeah.
The Rabbi mentioned that the same pasuk is called Avim and the
stamp
is called
the same. Yeah, in the Akedah, at the end of the Akedah, it's in the same pasuk. Right, so that's exactly the point that Shemi Shmuel is making. In other words, that both metaphors are used together. One is for quantity, one is for quality.
And one of them doesn't mean you use the Lashon for Ar.
Right, over there in the Akedah, Harba Arbe Zarcha Kechokvei Hashamayim
V'chach. So, isn't it one can assume that when it says Arbe, it means quantity?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think it's a good point. Harba Arbe, right? It's a double language. Why the double language? Right? So the truth is, Rav can mean two things. Rav can mean great in quantity. Rav can mean great in quality as well, right? So the truth is, it works beautifully. The pasuk harba arba ezarecha kechokve hashamayim v'chachol asher osfas hayom. I will increase them. I will increase them numerically, and I will increase them qualitatively, right? Like the stars and like the sand, right? It works, and the double lashon fits in beautifully with that. Again, even without getting too midrashic, even just on the level of pashut pshat, it fits in very beautifully. And the truth is, again, contextually, if you think about it, the perfect time for God to say to Avraham Avinu, "Wow, your kids are going to be great," is after the Akedah, meaning you have just demonstrated an incredible level of self-sacrifice that's almost unimaginable, right? So you're not only going to have a lot of kids, you're going to have special kids, right? And it's a reasonable thing for God to promise Avraham Avinu after the events of the Akedah. Now, and then he goes on the following: the Hinei. Every star, says the Shemi Shmuel, has a task, and every star is the conduit to bring divine influence into the world, whether for good or for bad. Right? Now this is Astrology 101, right? So just in case you didn't remember that course from your college days, Baruch Hashem, we're able to bring you a little astrology here tonight. But basically the idea, you know, that that's basic, you know, to the idea of astrology, we should point out that with the noted exception of the Rambam, most of the Rishonim accepted that there was something to the science of astrology, namely that the stars are identified with different powers, and that each star is a conduit to bring some kind of influence into the world, right? Truth be told, you know, even if one were to take a Rambam position vis-a-vis astrology, you know, and to say that no, that's not true, you know, the stars don't have any particular power. The basic point that the Shemi Shmuel is making, I think, still holds, you know, even from that perspective, meaning whether this works exactly this way or not, but we associate certainly, you know, the stars with each one having a certain tafkid, each one having a certain role, and each one having a unique channel to bring some kind of divine influence, you know, into the world. We're speaking in Bialystok for sure. We've got all these mazalos upstairs, you know, so we definitely, you know, definitely got to plug into that in some way or another.
What's Madonna's role?
Yeah, I'm not even going to go there. Uvasher Yisrael, Nimshu l'akochavim, heim em so'im l'chius elokus tanim so'os ba'olam. Now, with that understanding, again, that every star has its own power, and every star has its own role, and every star has its own function, says the Shem Yishmol, that's also another dimension of the Jewish people being compared to stars. Because the same way the stars are a vehicle to bring godliness into this world, you know, to bring divine influence into this world, so too the Jewish people are a vehicle to bring divine influence and to bring godliness into this world. If God forbid, we could imagine that the Jewish people would cease to exist, the world itself would cease to exist. The Jewish people's continued existence is critical for the ongoing existence of the world itself. Just as if the stars were to cease to exist, the world also would cease to exist. Again, this is not an astronomical statement, right? Because an astronomer would argue with this statement. The astronomer would say, no, the world could, the existence of stars is not a prerequisite for our world to continue to exist. Our world just needs the sun to exist. It doesn't need other stars. But, from an astrological point of view, if the stars are the medium through which God sends his influence down into this world, if that medium ceased to exist, so then we would not be able to receive that that influence from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Yeah.
Is there any indication that the stars that exist in the world
that what? Say again. So meaning is astrology potentially a form of Avodah Zarah? Again, most Rishonim felt that astrology was a valid science. Obviously, if you worship the stars, that's a problem, right? That's a big problem. That Avodah Zarah is also referred to as Avodas Kochavim Umazalos, right? Worshipping the stars and the constellations. So just say no. But the classic position on astrology that the Rishonim had was, no one's worshipping the stars, but there is a science, by which we understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu somehow uses the stars as a medium through which to exert his influence on this world, right? It's not that the stars have any independent power, but the stars are representative. Again, if you want to put it in somewhat more modern terms, God created this thing called nature, and through nature he exerts an influence on the world, and nature is symbolized by the stars, in that kind of way. Why does Kiddush Levana play into astrology? Again, astrology means the science that assumes that the stars exert an influence on our actions. Right? The rabbi was a tremendous astronomer, but astronomy and astrology are two different things. Astronomy means the science of studying the motion of the stars. Not that they influence us in any way, but just to know, this. So that's astronomy. In other words, to calculate, the moon's going to be here, the moon's going to be there, all that kind of stuff. That's astronomy. Astrology is to assume that where the stars happen to be lined up have some kind of influence on our lives.
And
right. So the Rambam says they were a bunch of fakers. Right. Very power, very convincing fakers, but the Rambam holds that everything they were doing was fake. Right. Yeah.
I'm not testing your knowledge of astronomy. I don't know, or craniology for that matter, but if the stars cease to exist, do we know that the universe would exist?
Right, so again, he's just focusing on the following point. Again, assuming this idea that the stars exert an influence on our lives, which is astrology, right?
Okay.
So again, a scientist today would probably deny that assumption, but you know, assuming that that's the case, so of course you need the stars to be there, because the stars are the conduit through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, exerts an influence upon this world.
Right. Right. So it's like they're, but even from an astronomy point of view, not an astrology point of view, from an astronomy point of view, the universe is constructed in such a way, don't we think that if stars weren't there, the universe would be a very different, may not even exist.
Right, so again, I'm not an astronomer,
right.
But I think if you were to ask an astronomer would tell you that there are stars that die, and stars that have died.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the universe certainly continues to exist even with stars dying. So if you asked an astronomer, let's say 90% of the stars in the universe were to die, would that affect the rest of, you know, the other 10% of the universe, that it wouldn't be able to continue? I suspect an astronomer would probably tell you that as long as our sun stays alive, you know, we're fine. You know, the fact that other stars, the sun is a star, right? So the fact that other stars die doesn't really have an influence on us. I suspect an astronomer would probably tell you that. Again, I would defer to a real astronomer as opposed to some guy who's trying to say Shirim to Mincha Meir. But you know, I assume that they would probably say that. But again, let's go back to the Shemesh Wolf for a moment. So, you know, the Shemesh Wolf says again, astrologically, the stars are crucial for the universe. They are the vehicle through which godliness comes into the world. So too, we, the Jewish people, are the vehicle through which godliness comes into the world, and we are critical for the existence of the universe. And then he adds the following: Uchimo kol kochav v'kochav prati yesh lo memshala u'mishtar prati ba'aretz. Every star has its own unique job, and every star has its own unique function.
Like angels,
right? Yeah, kind of like angels. Every star has its own unique function. You know, we're going to bring it back to angels eventually, right? Kain kol ish yisrael hutzinor prati v'yesh lo memshala pratis. So too, every Jew has his own unique mission, and every Jew has his own unique conduit to bring God's glory and His holiness into this world. Meaning, what I can accomplish, you can't accomplish. What you can accomplish, I can't accomplish. And that's true for every single person. In other words, each of us has our own unique role to play in the world, our own unique task, the same way that each star has a unique role to play as well. V'mchas v'shalom mekalko ma'asov. And if a person doesn't behave properly, lo es atzmo levadhu mekalko. He doesn't simply mess himself up. But he messes up his whole conduit of bringing godliness into the world. And anyone that you were supposed to influence by being that conduit is going to be negatively influenced. The same thing, if a star were to disappear from the sky, it would throw off the whole unit. Right? Now, if you want to put this in somewhat scientific terms, I think they call this the butterfly effect. I think we spoke about this maybe last week or the week before. Namely, you know, the idea that everything in nature is so interconnected that if a butterfly flaps its wings, you know, halfway across the world, that ultimately has a chain effect that, you know, affects everything, you know, across the, you know, in the entire world, right? In other words, everything is ultimately connected in some way or another. That's essentially what he's saying over here from an astrological perspective. You know, every Jew has to realize that he's an important part in this puzzle called the world. And if you mess yourself up, you're messing up the balance of the world as well. Just like the stars all have to be in the right place, you know, and they have to be aligned in order for the world to function the way it does. So in other words, what he's done in this paragraph is, says Hashem Yishmuel, the comparison between Jews and Kochavim and stars is qualitative. Not just that we're all important like stars, but we also are sources of influence like the stars, and each of us is a unique source of influence like the stars, and each of us has a unique role and task which really can't be fulfilled by anybody else. That's the comparison to stars. Now, take that, and let's just go on to the following idea. Well, if he ha'amar, yuvan heitev inyan ha'minyan. Let's go back to the original question. Why is it necessary to count the Jewish people before God causes his Shechina to devolve upon them? So he says as follows. Haminyan oz lo hayarach leida hamisfar. The point of the census was not just to know how many Jews are out there. It wasn't just God, you know, counting up. Because again, for that, God can, you know, God doesn't need to count. Elohumi loshen hismanus. Sheyip kod ish al mishmarto. The word minyan can mean accounting, but the word minyan can also mean an assignment. Hismanus. Hismanus means an appointment. When God is mone the Jewish people, it doesn't just mean that he's counting them, it means that he's assigning the Jewish people. He's giving every Jew his task. Sheyifkod ish al mishmarto. Right? Every Jew is being given his task. Just like every star has its task, every Jew has his task as well. V'nikra aminim pikudim in Russian hafkedis halavim. Shuminoi memshola. V'oz hakonim sar biyad Yisrael. Right? Just the idea of pikudim, lifkod, means not only to count, but lifkod, like the word mifaked in modern day Hebrew, means to command somebody to do something. Right? By the counting that takes place in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar is really less of a census and more of an assignment of tasks. Right? Every Jew is being given his task at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. And with that, let's just add the following, and then we'll continue Be'ez Hashem a little bit after Meir, but this is sort of the clincher. Well, if he ha'amur, yesh l'farish divrei Rashi, kishtabola hashros shchinaso aleh mina'am. Now, finally, let's come back to Rashi. Rashi says, why did God count the Jewish people in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar? Because he was about to cause the Shechina to devolve upon them. So good. So God needs a count before the Shechina can come down on them? No. Hashros Hashchina hoista kmo b'chlal came b'prat al kol echad ve'echad. Uvazem nimster lo mashashayach elov kanal. What does it mean that the Shechina rested upon Klal Yisrael? It means that God's presence came into the Jewish people, and every Jew was given his task by means of which he would continue to bring God's presence into the world. So before bringing the Shechina down onto Klal Yisrael, God first has to give each Jew his assignment. Right? It's not Shas that he's just counting them, oh, let's see how many Jews there are out there. No, he's giving each Jew his assignment to know what he's supposed to do and what role he's supposed to play in Klal Yisrael. God's not going to just bring down the Shechina willy-nilly. God's going to bring down the Shechina with a plan. He's going to give the Jewish people, each person, a task, a tafkid that they have to carry out, and then the Shechina can be brought down. And that's why it was necessary to have a minyan, to have a counting, not a counting, but an assignment of tasks in order to enable the Hashroas Hashchina to be meaningful and to let the Jewish people carry out what needed to be carried out.
Jewish people knew what then and there that they were being assigned. That was this parenthetic, that God and Shemayim said, Moshe Ben David is going to do this. I mean, did they get the message?
My understanding of the Shem Yishmol is that, yeah, in other words, the counting is not just one, two, three, not one, not two, but marching orders, like you say, and that's all implicit in this Sefer. And by the way, that could help us explain why the Sefer is called Chumash HaPkudim. Good, so there's a census for the first couple of Prakim in the Sefer. Who cares? That's the whole Chumash? No, because this is the assignment of tasks, much more than just a census, right? Be'ez Hashem will pick up after Ma'ariv and see the sort of the epilogue that the Shem Yishmol puts into place over here. Chanan ben Akasha Omer Rostak Kodesh Baruch Hu. So this is part two of the Shem Yishmol Shir on Parshas Bamidbar. Again, so we saw a piece from the beginning of Tov Reish Ayin Beis from the Shem Yishmol, where he wonders why it is that it was so necessary to count the Jewish people at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. Rashi tells us that it was necessary to do so because God wanted to allow His Shechina to devolve upon the Jewish people. But the Shem Yishuvel says, what does that mean? The Ribbono Shel Olam needs to count in order to make the Shechina devolve upon them? I mean, he knows exactly how many Jews there are. So the basic idea that the Shem Yishuvel develops is that the counting is not just a census, the counting is an assignment. Right? Pikod means not just to count, but to give people marching orders. And every Jew is a star. Every Jew has a unique tafkid, a unique mission, a unique task. And God tasks the Jewish people, each and every one, with his own unique task at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. And that's really what the counting is all about. And yes.
How do you know what your mission is?
What's that?
How do you know what your mission is?
Got to come to the Shem Yishuvel Shia. Right, so. Again, it goes back to what Shelley said before. It would seem the way the Shem Yishuvel is understood in the Pesukim is that in this particular case, God did share with the Jewish people what everyone's unique mission was. The question becomes, okay, in our own day and age, you know, most of us are not privy to divine communications telling us, you know, what our unique mission is. So I think, again, if one can suggest very humbly, you know, the Ribbono Shel Olam has a way of causing us to fall into situations which enable us to fulfill our missions, you know? So sometimes the way to figure out our mission is just to see where the Ribbono Shel Olam takes us. And, you know, sometimes he takes us to places where we didn't necessarily anticipate going. And that, in its own right, you know, is the sign that that's supposed to be our mission, some way or another. So, again, so, yeah.
Just quickly. Also, it seems what we're discussing is the mandate flows from Hashem to the person. The mandate to adopt your mission in life. How about the idea, I'm just wondering, how about the idea that by being counted you feel like some significance, you know, you're a number, you have a number, you're part of Klal Yisrael. How about it devolving on the person? The significance of the counting devolves on the person.
Right, so very interesting. So Rav Moshe is that some, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if I'm not mistaken, had a mahalach like that as to the significance of the counting over here, and as the counting is significant not because God needs to know how many we are, but we need to know that each of us count, and for, you know, when we know that we all count, so then that's a vehicle to enable the Shechina to come into Klal Yisrael. And that's what Moshe explained. That's why Bamidbar is always read shortly before Shavuos, because for Kabbalah Tatara we also have to be imbued with that sense that each of us counts, you know, that we're not just faceless, members of Klal Yisrael, but each of us has our own unique significance, right? So that idea from Rav Moshe is not exactly what the Shem Yishuvel is saying, but it certainly works very well with what the Shem Yishuvel is saying. Yeah. Rabbi Reuben, yeah.
Okay. Now I understand a little better the connection between Bamidbar and just explaining Christ died. It's spoke about Erechim.
Right. Oh, very good.
Value.
Right.
Because it's for self-worth. It's for able to.
Very, very good. So Rabbi Reuben points out the end of Vayikra is all about Erchin, the value of the individual. It's a very nice tie-in, you know, to the notion of the value of the individual as articulated, you know, by the Shem Yishuvel and Rabbi Moshe in, you know, their explanation beginning of Bamidbar. Very, very nice. Yeah.
Certainly not my word, but I heard that obviously one letter in the Torah is possible.
Right. The whole thing is no good. Right. Right, right, right. It's right. It's all the same, you know. The every individual has their own significance. So having developed that idea that the idea of counting is more assignment than it is just, you know, census. So the Shem Yishmuel writes the following, just an addendum. L'fi ha'omo yesh l'farish divrei Rashi Perek Aleph Pasuk Mem Tes Achas matei levi lo sifko. Right, at the end of all of the counting, very, very long perek that goes through the census of the entire Jewish people, the Pasuk says Achas matei levi lo sifko. Don't count Shevet Levi. So why shouldn't you count Shevet Levi? In other words, they're going to have a separate census. Don't count them amidst the rest of the census of Klal Yisrael. So Rashi there gives two interpretations. Why should Shevet Levi not be counted amidst the rest of the Jewish people? Number one, he says, Kedai hu ligyon shomel chiyos nimna levado. You know, because the Levim are special, they deserve their own special counting. Okay, we're not going to talk about that. Rashi then gives a second pshat, where he says as follows, a harder pshat to understand. Safa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shasidu La'amod Gzera Kol HaNimnim Ben Esim Shana V'mayla Shiyamusu B'amidbar. The Ribbono Shel Olam, of course, was able to foresee that, you know, after the sin of the Meraglim, anyone from the age of 20 and up would, you know, be doomed to die in the desert and not go into Eretz Yisrael. Amar al yiyu elu bichlal l'fi shehem shalish lo tol ba'ego. So God says, being that anyone who's counted in the census is going to be, you know, is going to be doomed to not go into Eretz Yisrael, I don't want the Levian to be touched by that Zera. Let the Levium not be in the general count. After all, the Levium didn't worship the Egel, so therefore they deserve to be spared from the punishment of the Chet HaMiraglim. Right? That's Rashi's second pshat. Yesh Lahavim says the same Yishpoh. What a strange pshat. Think about it for a moment. L'chara ein haminyan garin. Why should Rashi seems to imply that if you're included in the census, you're doomed to not go into Eretz Yisrael because of the Chet HaMiraglim. But if you're not included in the census, regardless of what you do, somehow not being included in the census spares you from the fate of the Jewish people after the Chet HaMiraglim. Somehow it's being part of the census which is the determining factor. So it says the Shemesh Shmuel, that's strange on two counts. First of all, Yoshua the Kalev Shenimnu mikomakom chayu meho anoshim ahem. Yoshua and Kalev were included in the original count, right? And yet they survived even after the Gzeira of the miracles. That's number one. Right? So you can be in the count and still make it in Eretz Yisrael, not be subjected to the sin of the to the punishment that was given to the miraglim, right? Moreover, this he says a little bit later on. You know, we find that the Levium did not participate in the Chet HaEgel. That's true. We don't see that the Levium didn't participate in the Chet HaMiraglim. Right? So, as far as we know, they did participate in the Chet HaMiraglim because we don't know otherwise. So, it's a little strange, right? So, in other words, if you tell me they didn't participate in the Chet HaMiraglim and that's why they're spared the Gzeiros, so that I understand. But if the Levium did participate in the Chet HaMiraglim, and they're just being spared the punishment. Why? Because they weren't included in the census. That seems very arbitrary, you know? In other words, they didn't participate in the Egel. So to reward them for not participating in the Egel, God gives them a separate census so that when eventually they do sin with the Meraglim, they don't get the same punishment as the rest of Klal Yisrael, because only those counted in the original census are going to be doomed to not go into Eretz Yisrael. It seems very convoluted, right? In other words, you know, if the Levium sinned by the Meraglim, they should be punished. If they didn't sin with the Meraglim, so then they shouldn't be punished. Right? What's the census got to do with anything? Right, but in other words, did they react when the Meraglim came back and said, you know, we don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael? We don't find that the Levium stood out.
Plus it says that the whole nation died out during the 40 years.
No. We don't find that Vatitza kol ha'eda vayitnu es kolom ba'layla ha'hu doesn't say besides the Levium. Sounds like the Levium were also crying. You know, we want to go back to Mitzrayim. We don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. Right? We have no indication to the contrary. So, if that's the case, so again, Rashi writes over here that the Meraglim were not, that the Levium were not punished. The Levium were able to go into Eretz Yisrael. They were not subject to the Gzeira of the Meraglim. Why? Because they weren't part of that census. What's that got to do with anything? Were they part of the Chet HaMiraglim? Were they not part of the Chet HaMiraglim? If they were, so the Chet they should be punished. If they weren't, So then what do I care that they weren't in the census? The reason that they didn't go, you know, the reason they weren't punished is because they weren't part of the Chedem Meraglim.
So did they participate in the morality?
Sounds like they did. Sounds like they did.
They did.
Sounds like they did.
Right. By the Ado, did they use the Lashon of Ada, Lashon of people?
I don't think it, off the top of my head, I don't think it says the Lashon Ada over there.
I'm trying to see if they're, if they use the same Lashon and the Levium were not included, and then we find by the Meraglim the same Lashon,
right.
So we can assume maybe that the Levium were not included.
Right, I mean, the truth is by the Meraglim, by Tisa Kol Ha'eda, the entire congregation, it sounds very inclusive over there. You know, so again, I mean, unless there's an indication to the contrary, he seems to assume the Levium, you know, did sin with the Meraglim. They may not have sent a Meragil, but, you know, it sounds like they were kvetching together with everybody else.
And the women didn't cry. And Torah said, you know that the women went in. So the women went in and they were they didn't sin by the Meraglim. So why can't we say the opposite? The Levium also went like the women.
Good. So if the Levium didn't cry, so what do you have to tell me that they're not in the census? Right? As Rashi says, the reason that they were spared going into Eretz Yisrael, right? The reason that they were spared and allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu had Rachmanis on them, we didn't put them in the census. What do you mean? You know? So did they sin? Did they not sin? So it sounds like as follows. Let's try to understand this. Ula now yesh lomar digzeras ha-meraglim nami ha-yisalafi shehem ha-yum emunim al isher ha-olam. Al shleimus nafsham, al kain haya aleihem onesh. The ilu yitzu yershelo hayu memunim kanal lo igil aleihem kol kach onesh basher kavanosam hayso lashlamas nafsham. Shem Yishmul said a lot over here, so let's try to unpack it a little bit. There's a concept which starts with the Zohar and which is elaborated upon by other mefarshim in trying to explain the chet ha-meraglim. What possessed Klal Yisrael to not want to go into Eretz Yisrael, right? Again, a simple pshat l'psukim, they got nervous, they got scared, right? But the Zohar and the Mefarshim have a hard time understanding that. You know, this is the generation that stood at Har Sinai, saw God reveal the Torah. You know, the whole point of leaving Mitzrayim was to come to Eretz Yisrael. They got scared off by looking at some big fruit and hearing some stories about some, you know, big giants. Really, that was it. So the Zohar and the Mefarshim explain the following. Klal Yisrael in the Midbar were in a state of tremendous ruchnius, tremendous spirituality. They were living the Kola lifestyle, let's call it what it is, right? They sat and learned all day, you know, they had mom falling for them, they drank the water from the Be'er, you know, there was no physicality whatsoever. When they would come into Eretz Yisrael, Nebuch, they'd have to engage, I'm afraid to say, a four-letter word here on tape, but they'd have to engage in work, lo aleinu, right? You know, they'd have to till the soil. They'd have to engage in physical actions. No longer could they, quote unquote, sit in kollel, right? They would have to transfer from an entirely spiritual life to a partially physical life. And basically, Klal Yisrael said, we don't want that. We want to stick around in the Midbar. We want to stay in the Beis Medrash. We're not interested in going out and working the soil, working the land. That's not our interest at all. So they were punished. But, you know, again, their sin, in a sense, is a noble sin, right? It's a sin of wanting to cling to spirituality, not a low-level sin of just, you know, being afraid and not trusting fully in the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the way the Zohar understands the sin of Klal Yisrael. Now, says the Shem Yishmol, this idea of understanding the sin fits back into the idea of counting. In what way? Because again, counting means the assignment of a task. The task that was given to Klal Yisrael was, while you are in the desert, engage in spirituality exclusively. But your task will change when you come into Eretz Yisrael, you will transition into a more physically oriented task, and that's your job. What happens when an employee goes back to his employer and says, I don't want to transition the way you want me to? The employer says, okay, so we will transition you out of this job. Right? Now, the sin of the Jewish people, says the Shemi Shmuel, was to not be faithful to their task. Their task was be spiritual while you're in the desert and then become physical. They say, no, we don't want to do that. We want to stay spiritual. We're not looking to move on, you know, to the next task, to the next level of our, you know, of our assignment. Okay, so that's betraying the assignment that was given to you. So where did Leviim come into this? So he says as follows: V'nei lo matzil b'shevet Levi shelo ishtadfu b'miraglim. We don't find that Shevet Levi was not a part of the sin of the Miraglim, like we said before. I mean, it sounds like the Shevet Levi was, you know, as reluctant to go into Eretz Yisrael as everybody else. Let me summarize this, perhaps adding like just one nekuda or so. The task of the Levium is fundamentally different than the task of the rest of Klal Yisrael. The rest of Klal Yisrael was told, while you're in the Midbar, be spiritual, but then when you come into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to transition into a different task, you're going to work the land and engage in a mostly, you know, physical type of pursuit. The Levium were always given the task to be spiritual. Even when they come into Eretz Yisrael, they're supposed to be involved in things spiritual, not things physical. So for the Levium to say, we want to stick around the desert and continue our life of spirituality, relatively speaking, is not really an abdication of their task. Right? In other words, for the rest of Klal Yisrael to say, we want to stick with spirituality, we don't want to move on to the physical phase, is a betrayal of what they're supposed to be doing. For the Levium to say that, it's actually not so off. In other words, you know, you can say, well, you know, instead of sticking around the desert and being spiritual, you're supposed to move into Eretz Yisrael and be spiritual. Okay, but relatively speaking, it's not that far off from what they're really supposed to be doing. So the Ribbono Shel Olam has less of a taina, or no taina at all, against the Levium, and they're not punished because of the sin of the Miraglim. They may have also said, we don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael, but for a Levi to say, I don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael, is substantially different than for a Yisrael to say, I don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. So what's this got to do with the counting? Right? Again, Rashi seems to indicate because the Levium weren't in the census, that's why they weren't punished with the Chet HaMiraglim. What does that mean? So again, says the Shemi Shmuel, it goes back to Ar Yisod. Being in the census is not just a question of whether you count. The census is the function of assigning a task. When the Levium are not in the census with the rest of Klal Yisrael, it's another way of saying they have a different task than the rest of Klal Yisrael. Their task is a task of spirituality exclusively. So because they have a different task, i.e., they're not included in the census with the rest of the Jewish people, mimela, they're not in the same position when it comes to the Miraglim, because, you know, their reluctance to go into Eretz Yisrael is not a betrayal of their task in the same way in which the reluctance of the rest of the Jewish people to go into Eretz Yisrael is a betrayal of their task. Right? Very, very fascinating way of explaining that particular Rashi. Right, so according to the Shemi Shmuel, the Levium would have known this task of theirs from the time that they were set aside. In other words, by the Chet HaEgel, when Shevet Levi was told, okay, you're going to be it, right? So now they were given the assignment of spirituality, which would last even once they went into Eretz Yisrael. They were apparently aware of that, the way the Shem Yishmol
spread spirituality.
Right.
There was already, even in Mitzrayim,
a degree of it. Right, but at the latest, by the Chet HaEgel, maybe that's the better way of putting it, you know, they were already aware of the special role that they were going to possess. Okay, so we want to wish everybody a wonderful Shavuos, a wonderful Yom Tov, and Be'ez Hashem. Next week, again, following Mincha, we'll pick up again with this Shem Yishmor and Parshas Nosra.